It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin political scientist on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and what Russia's goals may be at this point. First, it's Election Day in Wisconsin, and elections can often get people reflecting on how things are going in their lives at the state, local, national, and international levels. Are we prospering? If yes, do we reward the incumbents? If no, do we give someone else a chance? We don't have any state or nationwide races on the ballot today. There are a lot of domestic and global issues to reflect on. And our next guest is offering reasons for us to be positive about America's position in all of it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How prosperous do you feel like the United States is in this moment? What does prosperity look like to you? Do you feel like the country is on a strong economic footing, its recovery from the early days of the pandemic? What threats do you see to American prosperity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Koplovich is a professor in the Political Science Department and the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He's director of European Studies at UW. He recently wrote in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about what he believes to be America's ongoing, enduring prosperity and strength, despite inflation, the war in Ukraine, and other problems. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again. It's nice to be back.
I want to talk about the why, first of all. You wrote this piece. You said a feeling of skepticism, pessimism out there in the American media and the public.
Yes. So, I wrote this mainly as a reaction to what I've been seeing in terms of the public and political debate about the state of the economy in the United States. We have just lived through a 2-year pandemic, which is unprecedented. But we've also had an unprecedentedly rapid and successful economic recovery. Right. So unemployment was nearly 15% in April of 2020. And by pretty much every metric in terms of jobs, income, consumption, investment, whatever economic activity you're talking about, we've had basically a full recovery economically since the onset of the pandemic, which is, by comparison to the global financial crisis, it took us over a decade and we never really fully recovered, or the Great Depression, which took years and years to recover from. That was sort of my reaction was, yes, inflation is high and inflation is higher than it's been in a very long time. But inflation is high around the world, right? The levels of U.S. inflation are roughly the levels of inflation that you're seeing in the European Union countries, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, et cetera. And so it just sort of seems to me there's a bit of a disconnect between how well the U.S. economy is actually doing and has recovered. And we've had a much better and faster recovery than the other countries I just mentioned. And the state of the political debate, which is, the U.S. economy is terrible. Right. Unemployment is incredibly low right now. Inflation certainly is eroding people's incomes now. But if you actually look at the data and factor in the money that most households received from stimulus checks and the child credits and all of the policies that were put into place by the U.S. government over the last year or so, real income and real consumption actually haven't gone down. Right. So it seems there's a sort of a disconnect between how much the public is suffering and how bad the economy is doing. And what the data suggest is the U.S. economy is actually doing well, very strong, both in absolute terms and relative to other countries that we might compare ourselves to.
In your piece, you refer to some surveys showing the American public worried about the economy. There's been some other survey data where Americans think unemployment has gone up in recent months and when it's gone down. I want to throw in a word here that might account for the discrepancy between the data you're pointing toward and how people feel. Uncertainty. All through COVID, it seems like there's always another shoe we're waiting for to drop. Do you think that may account for some of that difference?
Absolutely. Again, we're living through unprecedented times, and is uncertainty about the geopolitics and war, about the state of the economy, about the next wave of the coronavirus pandemic. I think that's what a lot of the public opinion surveys are picking up. I do also think that there's an aspect of framing and media cues and coverage. I think one of the things I mentioned in the op-ed is the the ratio, I've been tracking the amount of coverage about inflation relative to unemployment in the media for the last year or so. And it's something on the order on a month-to-month basis of about a 12-to-1 ratio of articles on inflation versus unemployment. Right. And actually, in the last couple of months, that ratio is more like 20-to-40-to-1. And so I think, you know, we saw this the last few weeks with gas prices, that people hear a lot about inflation is really high. It's a huge problem. Here's what's going on with gas prices. There's been relatively little coverage about, you know, the unemployment rate has fallen from the highest level it's been in 80 years to the lowest level it's been in 80 years in the last 10 months. Right. And, you know, I think that it's the combination of both of those things, and obviously politics as well. Right. You know, in any political system, the opposition party has lots of incentive to say that the economy is doing poorly and blame the incumbents for what's going on. And, you know, that's a feature of politics. It's not something that's specific to the United States. But I think some of that is what's going on as well.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, he wrote a piece saying, hey, America, the United States is more prosperous than you might think it is. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our calls, Mark, one question is, okay, compared to what? And there's, I think, a concern that, okay, China is on the rise. Russia is this threat. We've got these rival countries representing different government systems. And there's a fear that somehow they're doing better than us, gaining on us, overtaking us in some way.
Right. And this is actually, you know, the what we've been talking about so far was kind of the short-term set of developments that I've been thinking about. But the other reason I wrote this piece is the longer-term developments and narratives. You know, the point is not to deny that there are serious problems in the United States, economic and politically, or that, you know, households and individuals aren't facing hard times because of inflation. But if you look at the problems of the U.S. relative to the challenges and difficulties that China and Russia face, we are unquestionably stronger, right? And the big thing I wrote about in the piece was on the monetary and financial side. You know, I study the economic side of international relations. And, you know, one of the things you've actually seen is that on display in the last several weeks with the Western sanctions led by the U.S. on Russia. Right? The U.S. global economy runs on dollars. Interest rates are unprecedentedly low. And the United States' ability both to borrow and invest and spend is, you know, much, much stronger than China's or Russia's. There are political questions about whether we will do that. And there's political debates about debt and deficits, but our ability to actually borrow and spend is unprecedented. And what we saw with the sanctions was, you know, in a very, very short amount of time, the U.S., along with our NATO allies and European Union allies, and the Canadians and the Japanese, were basically able to completely choke off Russia from the global economy because the world economy runs on dollars and euros. And the financial sanctions have basically targeted Russia. And Russia has the ruble, and the ruble is not a global reserve currency. China has the renminbi. The renminbi is becoming somewhat more important in the world economy, but 60% of foreign exchange reserves that governments hold are dollars. Another 25% are euros. 2% are Chinese renminbi, right? And so there's a, you know, I think a lot of the debate about China, because China is large and they're big in terms of international trade, is that they're sort of surpassing the U.S. But when you look at things both on the military side and even more so on the money and financial side, the gap between the U.S. and China is still very large. And the gap between the U.S. and China on the one hand and Russia on the other is enormous.
We're talking to Mark Koplovich, professor in the political science department at UW-Madison. He says, despite multiple challenges, American prosperity is going pretty well right now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree or disagree with what you're hearing from our guest? What questions do you have? What factors do you weigh when you weigh the American economy? Call 800-642-1234. We'll hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about American prosperity and global strength, including financial strength. Mark Koplovich stays with us, professor in the Political Science Department and the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I work in the electrical industry. In the past 3 years, my income has gone down from 32 to 30 to 28,000 last year. I've worked more hours. I actually got a raise, but my buying power has decreased as well because I'm paying twice as much for gasoline. My insurance has gone up. My food costs have gone up. And even in the industry, copper prices have gone up. Aluminum has hit an all-time high. I mean, I do not see this as prosperity. I totally disagree with this professor. He needs to get out in the real world and talk to real people. The people who are building homes are borrowing money in order to pay these high prices. We're leveraging our prosperity on our future.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Mark?
Yeah. I appreciate the comment. I have been out. I have talked to lots of people. There are the aggregate numbers and there are the distributional effects, right? And it's important to think about, even when the U.S. economy is doing well, not everybody and not every sector of the economy is doing well. That is true in normal times and was true pre-pandemic. And there are a lot of distributional inequities. Some of those are urban versus rural. Some of those are one sector versus another sector. All of that is true, right? And there's enormous number of things that could be done to help individuals and to help households policy-wise that the U.S. government and the state government haven't done over many years, right? Prior to the pandemic, in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008. All of that is unquestionably true. And at the same time, as Rob, we were talking about earlier, the sort of compared to what question is to think about what the U.S. economy would have been like had we not had the economic policy response that we had, right? So the data that I've seen is that the average U.S. household received about $3,500 from the American Rescue Plan and the child tax credits and earned income tax credit, the set of policies we put in place in response to the pandemic economic crisis. And so in the absence of that, things would have been far worse, right? And it's true that households are spending more on food. It's true that households are spending more on utilities, they're spending more on gas when they go to the pump, et cetera. But if you net all of those things out for the average household, again, real income didn't decline, right, in the last year. And that's due to the policy response, right? And the policy response was deeply divisive politically. It was unpopular in large parts of the country, but it was unquestionably beneficial for the average household. And the U.S. economy has recovered, amongst the G7 industrialized economies. We are, I believe, the only economy that now actually has recovered and surpassed the 2020 levels. And so the policy response that we put in place relative to the UK, relative to EU countries, relative to Japan, et cetera, was much more aggressive and extensive. And it actually, insured American households and American individuals to a degree that other countries didn't, right? So again, as I was thinking about writing this, it's not that people haven't felt the pain of these crises, right? And it's not that everyone in the country has benefited. But in relative terms, right, both to China and Russia and relative to other countries we might compare ourselves to, the state of the U.S. economy is very, very strong. And the state of the economy relative to what it would have been absent the aggressive monetary and fiscal policy response is very, very good. Right. And again, I think that's absent from a lot of the media discussion, which is almost exclusively focused on inflation.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Tony joins us now in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I just disagree with this guy, and I'm going to tell you why, because he brings up averages. Well, me and LeBron James, if we average out our salary, we're making a lot of $1 million. But in the real world, I'm making about $50,000 a year, and LeBron James is making about $70 million a year. And the inflation doesn't bother him as much as it does me. But also at the same time, every time we have one of these recessions or something like that, it hits working class people harder and harder every single time. And the recoveries take longer and longer. Unemployment is not counted fully. Unemployment is only the people collecting unemployment, not people that are all on unemployment who stop looking for jobs or their skill sets do not meet new jobs because of lack of training resources.
Tony, I got you. We don't have too much time left. You gave us a lot to work with there. Mark, first of all, are we taking into account the inequity between Tony and LeBron James, for example, when we factor out the overall economy?
We are in the data. I mean, there, you know, the difference between the average and the median, which is the middle person, we are capturing that. But on the point about how we measure unemployment, you know, there's lots of different ways. You can look at labor force participation. You can look at real wages. You can look at the unemployment rate. You can look at unemployment by sector. Across all of these dimensions, we have returned to the levels that we were at prior to February 2020 and the onset of the pandemic. Right. So again, you know, as I said with the previous callers, it's the point is not to say that everything is equal and fair and that everyone in the economy is doing well. But, you know, the state of the economy relative to where we were 2 years ago, we had something that was as serious as the Great Depression, is as serious as the global financial crisis. And the economy on average and for most Americans has recovered. Right. And that doesn't mean that it's better for everybody. And it doesn't mean that obviously LeBron James is not bothered by inflation when he goes to the pump in the way that the caller was or I am or you are. But, you know, for most Americans, the situation of the economy now relative to what it was and the state of the economy relative to what we hear about how awful everything is. And this is the worst things have been in 40 years. I think there's a very large disconnect.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That's Mark Hoplovich, professor in the Political Science Department and the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about his piece on American prosperity. You can find a link to that Journal Sentinel piece at WPR.org/Central Time. Also, Mark is going to chair a related forum that's coming up on May 4th for the La Follette School. It's called American Power, Prosperity, and Democracy. That'll be live at Monona Terrace in Madison with a virtual option as well. Today's school board elections will shape local education policy for the next several years. The results will have the most impact on a group of people who mostly don't have a say at the ballot box, students. But as Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin students are finding other ways to make their voices heard.
Allie Schlicht is a junior at La Crosse's Central High School, where she's on the debate team. She's also part of a group of students in La Crosse who are working to connect the candidates in the local school board race to the students they'd be making decisions for.
That's probably always a concern of students, is a lot of times they just don't feel heard by adults. So that is something that we are, or I am looking for in a school board candidate, is somebody who would listen to students.
Allie and other students with the youth advocacy group Leaders Igniting Transformation organized forums for the school board candidates, where they asked about some of the issues they most want to see addressed.
According to the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction data from the 2018...
At a forum in March, Kaylin Adams noted that Black students are disproportionately likely to be suspended in La Crosse schools.
As a school board member, how would you go about reducing racial disparities and school discipline?
Kaylin got involved with lobbying the school board after going to racial justice protests in the summer of 2020 sparked her interest in political action.
The most only thing we could really do is just say what we need to say and then hope that it gets taken into consideration.
With the voting age at 18 and up, typically only seniors, and not even all of them, can vote for school board members. Allie says a board that answers more to students would probably look a little different.
I think a lot of the candidates would be focusing their campaign more on reaching the students and really seeing what they wanted more. Most likely also would be focusing their campaign strategies towards addressing the problems that students feel the most concerned about.
For the La Crosse students, one of those problems is mental health. They even successfully lobbied their board to put $100,000 of the school's federal relief funds toward mental health services. They also say addressing racial disparities and reducing the district's carbon footprint should be priorities. Some Wisconsin school boards have given students a literal seat at the table, if not a vote. Menominee Falls, Sun Prairie, Howard Suamico, and other districts have two non-voting student seats on their board. Bayport junior Kara Reen joined the Howard Suamico board in spring 2021, a contentious time when the state mask mandate had just been overturned and school boards were scrambling for next steps.
It was just very, very fiery school meetings for around since I joined. So being part of that, I think, just gives me more awareness about what's going on in my community.
She says all the uproar can be frustrating. Kara would like to see the board be able to focus on issues the student body cares about, like support and funding for social-emotional learning or equity and educational access, especially in areas like math and technology.
Really, this is about students from elementary to high school and being ready for the future. As a student, I just don't want the board to constantly have petty fights over things that really aren't about students or school board issues.
Rohan Gala is a Bayport senior and the other student board member. He says national arguments over race and library books and LGBTQ issues have been overtaking board meetings in Wisconsin. That's created what he calls a heightened tension around school board meetings.
Parents and the community members now see the importance of school board meetings and the things that school boards talk about. And so while I would like to see a lessening of tensions within the school board, I also don't think that that could happen.
In the meantime, Kara, Ali, and Kaylin say they've seen more of their fellow students interested in this year's school board elections than ever before. The students say they may not stay engaged with these school boards forever, especially if they move away for college or work. But it has made them passionate about political engagement and how they can make their voices heard. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we're taking another look at the Russian invasion in Ukraine. Russian troops appear to be moving eastward within the country after being pushed out of the capital region and areas in the north. There are growing concerns about war crimes with attacks on hospitals and schools, and there appears to be evidence in Bucha of a wave of execution-style killings. Meanwhile, President Zelensky is asking the United States for more support, requesting military aid, and asking Western countries to invoke stronger sanctions against Russia. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the U.S. is doing enough to support Ukraine? Should the U.S. send over more weapons? Are we already doing too much, do you think? What questions do you have about what's going on in Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a political scientist and professor at UW-Madison. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Russian forces apparently have been pushed or at least withdrawn away from Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. They're headed eastward to the area where Russia was already declaring those parts independent. What have you been watching for in those particular developments over the last week?
Well, unfortunately, what the world has seen is that the pullout of Russian troops has left a wake of civilian casualties that many people are talking about in terms of war crimes and just atrocities that are hard to stomach. So on the one hand, the pullout is good. It means Ukraine has recaptured territory north of its capital. But I think many people expect that this doesn't mean necessarily a reduction in the war effort by Russia, but a reconfiguration and a stronger push in the south and the east.
I want to talk about what Russia is hoping to get out of this. There was an editorial that's gotten a lot of attention in a state-run Russian news outlet titled "What Russia Must Do with Ukraine." Here's some quotes from it in translation. Denazification must be de-Ukrainization. Ukraine may not exist as a national state. Any attempt to create it leads to Nazism. Another quote, elites must be liquidated. They cannot be re-educated. The social swamp who supported them must experience terror of war and learn the lesson and pay for its guilt. That, in addition to the war crimes you mentioned, that seems like a state-approved justification for war crimes. What do you make of that and other statements from Russian media and leaders?
Yeah, well, it is really important to watch what they are saying. That is pretty clearly a sort of genocidal statement. That denies the right of Ukraine to exist as a state and actually calls for punishing civilians in Ukraine. So it's a very dangerous statement. And we know that the media in Russia is at this point totally controlled by the government. So there has to be some level of approval. On the other hand, I think one of the things to note is that the Russian government has tried out different rationales for explaining this war to its population, including claiming that they were winning, that there's very few casualties, that everything's going fine. I think it's going to be harder and harder for the government to claim that there's no casualties, that there's no losses, and they're going to have to explain why so much damage is being inflicted on Ukraine. So I think this is an attempt for another step in this denazification rationale, which is a absurd claim that Ukraine has been taken over by Nazis and they need to be stopped. So it's a very serious statement, but I think it is also a sign of desperation on the part of the government in order to come up with a rationale for its war losses.
Russia, there were some leaked documents early on that suggested that Russia thought within a few days this war would have been over. They would have been in control of Ukraine and controlling the destiny of the country. That clearly didn't happen. What, to the extent that we can understand it, what is the Russian goal now? Are they hoping to still control all of Ukraine, to destroy Ukraine, to control parts of it? I can't puzzle it out.
Yeah, I don't think they are capable of, quote, winning at this mm-hmm. point. I think that they are capable of inflicting much more damage and causing many more civilian casualties. So that's the scary part that I think of. But in terms of what their goals were, remember initially the idea behind it, to the extent there was a rational plan, was to recognize the independence of those two regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, in the east. And supposedly they were going there to help Russian citizens, Russian ethnic Russians living in those areas. And instead of just focusing on those areas, they moved towards Kiev and towards a larger invasion. So that led a lot of people to think that what they were trying to do was to take over the whole government, replace the Zelensky government with a sort of puppet government. And I think they were delusional enough to think that that would actually work. And delusional, I say, because they don't recognize the resolve and the commitment to a Ukrainian nation that we're seeing throughout Ukraine. So I think they initially thought it would be easy. They could just replace the government. It would be very simple. But they are not finding many collaborators. The Zelensky government did not fold, and the Ukrainian army has been tougher and more resilient than many people thought they would be. So at this point, what is their plan? Possibly to capture the south and east so that they have a connection between Crimea and those two areas of the Donbass that they want. But I don't know at this point that they're even going to be successful in that more limited goal.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera, political scientist, specialist in Russian and post-Soviet states at UW-Madison, looking at the latest news in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I want to give a listen to Ukrainian President Zelensky making a pre-recorded speech at the Grammys over the weekend. Here's a listen.
We defend our freedom to live, to love, to sound. On our land, we are fighting Russia, which brings horrible silence with its bombs, the death silence. Feel the silence with your music. Feel it today to tell our story.
President Zelensky calling on the music community there, but also calling for more support from the U.S. and the Western world. What tools are still in the toolkit for the U.S. and Europe when it comes to supporting Ukraine?
Well, there's, I think, two really important directions. One is further military aid to Ukraine. I think that that's going on, and I think there's discussions now, especially in light of the atrocities that we saw over the weekend, in terms of doing more. So I think there are options for more military aid. And that, I think, is first and foremost, because I don't think Putin is going to stop until he is stopped militarily. Second is the sanctions. And there are there's a range of additional sanctions that can still be put in place, including additional financial sanctions, additional secondary sanctions. But most importantly is the cutting off of revenue to the Russian government through cutting energy exports. primarily from Europe. So that's, I think, the big discussion going on now is how can Europe find a way to reduce 30% of its energy supply rather quickly. And I guess I would say for our American audience, in terms of what we can do, the U.S. is the largest producer of oil and gas, but we're also the largest consumer. And so when we want to support Ukraine, I think one of the things that we have to think about is how might we shift some of our consumption and exports to Europe to make up for some of the gap from Russia. So I think there's a lot of things that could be done, maybe not immediately, but there are ways to move away from buying Russian oil and gas. And that's going to be the key in reducing income for the Putin government.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Hi. I don't think that America has much credibility to deal with the situation over there. We've invaded, I don't know, maybe a dozen countries in the last 10 years, probably 50 countries at least before that point in time. But I think right from the beginning that they should have been like France, because anyone that knows anything about military stuff, Ukraine is not going to win. At least with France, when the Germans came in, they knew their country was going to be destroyed. So they let them come in and they worked from the inside. At least they still had a country intact. This country is going to look like Syria. Every building, actually, it won't be that bad, but it'll be bad enough. The country is partially destroyed already.
Dan, thanks for the call. Dan says, I guess Ukraine should have let the invasion roll in. I mean, I think Russia has demonstrated a willingness to kill people under areas that they control with or without military resistance.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that perspective definitely has its supporters, even in U.S. government. I mean, there are some people who think Ukraine should have just accepted as a fait accompli a Russian invasion. But yeah, the big worry is what we see under areas that were under Russia control is these mass killings of civilians and atrocities. And so that should give anybody pause about saying, well, if Ukrainians had just gone along with it, everything would have been fine. So I think that's probably not what would have happened if Ukraine had just surrendered immediately. But the other thing I think that's really important in this conflict is the moral clarity and the willingness of Ukrainians to fight in this case. Ukrainians are doing all the fighting. They're asking for weapons and supplies from NATO countries. And so it's a bit different from Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq in the sense of there isn't a complex situation of who might be in charge, who to support, which group wants what. There was a democratically elected government in place that's still in place. And so what to do in this case is not actually that complicated. And I think that's one of the reasons there's so much unity and support for Ukraine is because it's such a simply wrong situation in terms of the Russian invasion.
Yoshiko Herrera stays with us, political scientist, professor at UW-Madison, expert on Russia and post-Soviet states, giving an update on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the U.S. do? What do you want to see the U.S. not do when it comes to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with political scientist Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, looking at Russia's invasion in Ukraine and the U.S. and Western response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the U.S. role in Ukraine so far? Should we be doing more, doing less? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko, weapons, humanitarian aid sent from the U.S. and Western Europe, very much reluctance to do things like no-fly zones or anything that might lead to, in effect, you Americans and Russians shooting at each other. Could you talk about that reluctance?
Yeah, the reluctance is that Russia is a nuclear power. The United States, NATO have nuclear weapons. And so the big danger is that an escalation into a direct conflict between NATO and Russia could lead to a nuclear exchange. That's the big danger. On the other hand, the other side of things is to sit back and watch these mass atrocities and war crimes. And so that's the dilemma. There are no good answers here. I think the so we can't say if somebody wants a no-fly zone. No-fly zone means shooting down Russian planes. It means shooting down shooting areas that supply planes, airports, et cetera, within Russia. So no-fly zone, to some extent, to the extent it's enforced, actually means engagement between NATO and Russia. And so that's the reluctance on the no-fly zone per se. But I think the examples from the Cold War, where there were proxy wars, where we had the same dilemma, is that we should expect NATO, in this case, to do everything it can short of a formal engagement with Russia. So that's where I think there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes and the supporting Ukraine militarily. It's right for Ukrainians to keep pushing for more, but I think a lot of that is happening sort of behind the scenes. And the main reason for that is to avoid a direct confrontation, which could be very dangerous.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question. This would be much further down the road, but I wondered, would there ever be an opportunity for Ukraine to seek reparations from Russia for an unprovoked attack?
Tom, that's a great question. Morally, Yoshiko, it seems like, of course. Practically, it seems unlikely.
Yeah, it's very hard to say, especially if Russia is kicked out of various European institutions, which might be the place for adjudicating claims like that. Yes, I agree with you completely that morally, yes, practically, it's not clear. On the other hand, all this seizure of Russian assets abroad, it's not clear what's going to happen to those assets, but I could see that there may be a case to be made for using those towards reparations or rebuilding Ukraine.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine with Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison. Still time for your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko, I want to look at the view inside Russia now. I know public opinion in an authoritarian country is hard to gauge. The closest thing to independent surveys, though, seem to show a lot of support for Vladimir Putin since the invasion and support for the invasion yourself. How much can we know about that?
I think that what we know is there are a lot of people in Russia who support Putin, and that support for Putin translates into support for the role for the war. But we also know that there is a lot of discontent and there are a lot of people who don't support Putin. However, in the repressive context that we have now in Russia, where Putin has really cracked down on people, I mean, he is arresting young people for posts on social media from five years ago at this point. He's arresting high school students who posted parts of the Russian Constitution in their newspaper. I mean, he's really cracked down on people. And so people are not answering surveys in droves because it's just simply not worth the risk. So I think knowing the precise level of support for Putin versus for the war versus against him and against the war, it's very hard to say right now. And I would not take those surveys to be very meaningful. I don't think they tell us whether support for the war has gone up or not, or whether support for Putin has gone up or not because of the repressive context that's been instituted since the war started.
Right. If I were in Russia, I might be very reluctant to tell even an independent pollster, yeah, no, I don't like Putin, assume that would stay confidential.
Right. There's absolutely no incentive to do that. I mean, if you were going to wage a protest against the regime, that seems like not something I would risk it for. As a social scientist, I hate to say that, but I'm not sure a supposedly anonymous survey is what people are going to risk punishment for.
Where does this end up? How can there be any kind of negotiated settlement when at least part of the philosophy of the invading nation is that the invaded nation doesn't actually exist and the people don't exist as a separate entity?
Yeah, I think that at this point, unfortunately, Putin is going to stop when he is stopped militarily. So I don't really see anything other than a military defeat stopping him at this point. The sanctions are important because they weaken the state capacity in Russia and they weaken his ability to wage war. But they're not going to convince him that he's done something wrong because he simply doesn't care. So I think that that's why I think there has to be a strategy of both supporting Ukraine militarily and keeping up with the sanctions in order to weaken the government. In terms of Putin's survival within Russia, I think that hinges on whether he can convince people that the destruction of the economy and the destruction that is happening in Ukraine is not his fault. And I think that's a tall order. And I think we can see from the censorship, the repression, et cetera, that their strategy of normal media control isn't working very well. But I think whether he's able to deflect blame is going to determine the survival of his regime. But in terms of the war stopping, I think that is unfortunately going to be up to the Ukrainians.
Time for one more caller. Gary is with us in Kaukauna. Gary, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Hey, I got a couple of things. One is that I believe that we keep hearing all these sanctions that have been imposed over the last 9 months or whatever. You know, I haven't seen the scorecard on that. What's worked, what hasn't worked, how many sanctions we have left, and what's left in the quiver, so to speak.
Gotcha. I'm going to leave you there, Gary, because we don't have a ton of time left. Yoshiko, what do we know about the sanctions, especially the ones imposed in the last couple of months, how they've worked, and how much we have left in the tank to do more?
Yeah, well, so it's only been 40 days, really, since they've been imposed. I think the sanctions so far are unprecedented in scale, scope, and speed. I think a lot of experts on a scale of 1 to 10 would say we're at a 7 or an 8. So there is more to do, and more to do primarily focuses on cutting the energy exports and secondary financial sanctions. So there is more that can be done, and I would not be surprised this week if we see more of that happening in light of what happened over the weekend.
And in our last minute or so, Yoshiko, you mentioned earlier Russia potentially being removed from important world bodies. I think the UN Human Rights Commission may be kicking off the Russian representative, Ukraine, calling for Russia to be booted from the UN Security Council, taking away their veto. How significant would that be?
Well, it would be significant, but the UN moves very slowly. Mm-hmm. So I think the kicking them off the Human Rights Council is kind of a symbolic measure. It doesn't mean a lot. If they were to be removed from the Security Council, that would be a whole reshaping of the UN architecture. But I expect that would take a long time, and I wouldn't hold my breath for that.
And what do you have your eye on mostly this week?
Well, I think that I think the military aid and additional sanctions are what we need to do in terms of supporting Ukraine. And the other thing is, I think on the military front, it's just important to see where Russia is moving, what their actions are, because clearly their words are not very meaningful at this point.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Yoshiko Herrera, a political scientist and professor at UW-Madison. She joined us for a look at the latest news in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, what it could take to end that invasion, and what to watch for in the weeks to come.